Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Mike J. He has written extensively on scientific and medical history, and we're talking about his latest book, Mescaline, A Global History of the First Psychedelic. Mike, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here, Mark.
In the very beginning, this is a quote from your book. Mescaline launched the psychedelic era, but would play little part in its future. Talk to me about that, because when I was at university in the late 60s, people definitely were doing peyote mushrooms, but it really seemed like LSD was the one that won out.
Yeah, that's right. And so mescaline's got this odd status in psychedelic culture. You can't write it out because everybody remembers that it was Aldous Huxley and Doors of Perception.
That's right.
And his first mescaline trip, and that's where the word psychedelic was coined. That's where it comes from. But then very soon after that, LSD kind of took over, both, you know, in science, in the lab and in medicine, and also on the street. And I think for the same reason, which is just that, you know, if you make a gram of mescaline, that's like three doses. If you make a gram of LSD, that's, you know, 20,000 doses. You know, so which way are you going to go? So after that, mescaline had this kind of cachet. It became kind of legendary, and some people did make it, you know, the people who weren't chasing the buck. But, you know, once it was illegal, then, you know, anybody can call anything mescaline, right? So, and LSD was really what ended up launching the, you know, the psychedelic counterculture in the 60s.
It's interesting, though, because back in the late 60s, when people were still using the word like organic, you know, so if you did shrooms and if you did peyote buttons, you were sort of going, but it was really considered to be a different kind of experience. And the other thing is you got sick when you did the buttons, and with acid, you didn't get sick in the beginning, not the same way at all.
No, that's right. I mean, mescaline and, you know, whether it's in the cactus form or whether it's in the sort of form of the, pure drug, it's kind of, it does have this kind of much more physical quality, you know, it's kind
yep,
of
yep.
more nauseous, but it's also kind of, I think, it's quite euphoric.
It is.
That LSD isn't. So that's why it's kind of so fascinating, as I had to in this book, to read kind of every description of a mescaline experience I could, because they're so varied. You know, it's kind of like, it's a paradoxical experience that it's kind of like having this amazing, wonderful, euphoric, magical time while also feeling really, really sick.
Yeah, and the amazing thing is the history, especially the medical and then the social history of this. As again, a quote from your book, no mind-altering substance has been described more thoroughly and from such a variety of perspectives. And I never expected that. I mean, this was a total surprise to me reading the book.
Yeah, I mean, this is fascinating. And for me, that's kind of the most interesting bit of the science, in a way, is the 1890s, you know, the very first experiments.
Yeah, yeah.
Because at that time, if you're a scientist and you're investigating these mind-altering drugs, obviously you take them yourself, you know, to understand what the experience is. And also, a lot of those early scientific investigators were great writers. You know, some of them were novelists, but they were all great at medical description, you know, because in those days before diagnostic tick boxes, you had to be able to describe properly. So you get this whole kind of amazing sequence of descriptions of peyote experiences from the 1890s, you know, where some people are looking at it as, you know, neurologists taking it and thinking, you know, what's this doing in the brain? And then there are,
right,
you know, psychologists taking it and thinking, you know, how is this reconstructing my consciousness? And then there's, you know, people taking it from a more kind of aesthetic point of view, going, you know, how would I describe these visions? What do they look like? And then other people going, you know, is this a spiritual experience? And if so, what kind? So it's a much, much more diverse and much more intensely engaged science than we have today.
Let's begin with the cactus. And actually, there are two species, at least two species, of psychedelic cactus. There's the peyote cactus, which is this sort of little tiny button-like cactus. But the other one that I don't think most people are familiar with is the San Pedro.
No, that's right. There is another cactus that contains mescaline, not quite as such a high concentration as the peyote. And it's a completely different cactus. This is the whole strange thing about the natural history of mescaline. I mean, why does it only appear in nature in cacti? And then in two cacti that are so unrelated, as you say, the peyote is this tiny little kind of spineless button, The San Pedro is this huge, great, spiny, columnar cactus. It looks like a classic cartoon cactus, and it grows all over the Andes, and it grows, you know, very fast and kind of prodigiously all over from Ecuador through Peru and Bolivia. And it was not appreciated until recently just how ancient its traditions of use are. You know, there's a temple up in the Peruvian Andes, which, you know, has a sort of 3,000-year-old carving of a San Pedro in it. But it also wasn't appreciated really until the 60s that there were, you know, there was a whole culture of people still using it, you know, curanderos and shamans.
Right.
And there's a continuous tradition of its use in the Andes that we're only now just becoming aware of.
And it seems to have gone wherever either of these cacti are found. It seems like that the local indigenous cultures have been using them typically for religious ceremonies.
Yeah, there are sort of both in Peru, particularly in Mexico, there are two kinds of ceremonies that you get described, you know, from very early on, you know, from the first sort of Spanish, you know, sort of Jesuits and people to write about it. And on the one hand, there's this kind of one-on-one thing with the curandero and the patient where people will be looking to heal an illness or maybe to find the source of a curse or to sort of find out how some distant relative is doing, something that's to do with kind of clairvoyance. And, you know, you have the two people, sort of usually both, or sometimes one of them will take the cactus. So there's that kind of there's that ritual, which looks a little bit like a kind of non-Western version of, you know, our kind of psychotherapy. And then there's another type of ritual, which is a much more communal ritual, which is traditionally, you know, round a fire and all night, often with singing and dancing, you know, a big kind of ceremony where everybody gets into the same state of mind together.
Let's talk about mescaline chemically. It's a plant alkaloid. Talk to me about how common psychedelic plant alkaloids are.
An alkaloid is a sort of particular type of chemical compound, you know, based around a little ring of nitrogens. And there are lots of them in the plant and fungus kingdom. And many, many of them are psychoactive. For example, the coffee bean contains an alkaloid called caffeine. The tobacco plant contains an alkaloid called nicotine. These two very unrelated species of cacti contain mescaline.
Now, there are so many people that are in your history that I almost feel like you could write an entire book about them, that we're going to have to just skip around and just talk about one or two. Because there's a really interesting group of people here. But one of the people I was fascinated with is James Mooney of the Smithsonian Institution.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit about his history? He's from the Bureau of Ethnology originally.
That's right. He was a sort of self-taught ethnographer. He was of Irish extraction. He was fascinated by Indians, as they were at that point, you know, from an early age, incredibly knowledgeable. And it was extraordinary, that generation of ethnologists who were going out to the West and trying to collect tribal customs and rituals and practices, because they were swimming against the tide, really, of a federal Indian bureau that was just on a program of assimilation. So the general idea was that, you know, there weren't going to be any Indians in the future. They were just going to be Americans. So young Indians would be, you know, taken away to boarding schools where they'd be, you know, given a Christian education. They'd be told to talk in English and forget their old languages. And all the while this is happening, people like James Mooney are scrabbling around trying to save, you know, hundreds, thousands of years of culture before they're eradicated. And most of the other ethnologists at that time were not particularly interested in the peyote ceremony because this was something that had just grown up on the reservations. You know, it didn't have any kind of ancient provenance among the plains tribes. So most of them kind of felt, as did, you know, a lot of even progressive white folk who were interested in Indian culture, they felt that, you know, they saw peyote a bit like alcohol, a bit like, oh, this is a kind of sad, degenerate thing
happening
to the tribes on the reservations. And Mooney was one of very few who was like, no, this is actually the future of Indian culture. We need to really take it seriously and protect and preserve it.
And he's supposedly the first white man to attend a peyote ceremony?
Yeah, he's certainly the first one to describe it, and he was What he's famous for is his the big book he wrote about the ghost dance,
and
he
was
one of the very few white Americans to be allowed to witness a lot of the ghost dance ceremonies. And it was right while that was going on that someone sidled up to him in Anadarko, Oklahoma, and said, "You know, do you want to come and see a participate in a peyote meeting up in the woods tonight?" And that was in 1891, and he describes that, and that's the first description that we have from a white writer.
It's interesting because there was a Comanche, I think his name is Quenna Parker,
yep,
who also embraced the peyote religion as an alternative to the what he thought was a destructive ghost dance.
Yeah, Quenna Parker and James Mooney, they did meet in 1893, a meeting with quite momentous consequences. But before that time, they'd both come to the same conclusion, which was that the ghost dance was going nowhere. You know, this was kind of based on an apocalyptic vision, you know, that the world was going to roll up like a blanket and take all the white people away and go back to where we were before. Neither of them bought that. So, you know, for them, for the same reason, peyote was very, very important. This was a way in which, you know, the Indian beliefs and Indian culture could be maintained. It created this space in the teepee that was beyond the reach of white culture, you know, but we still had that kind of, you know, authentic sort of Indian medicine. So they both had the same perception of it, and they both had the same strategy in selling it to white audiences, you know, because the missionaries in the federal government at this time were saying, you know, variations of, you know, this is a terrible habit, it's kind of diseased, it's bad for you, it's something that Indians are going to have to, you know, abandon before they can become Christian and civilized. And Mooney and Quenna were both saying, no, this is actually, you know, the missions and the federal government should welcome this. You know, this is something that's bringing real stability to the tribes. You know, the people who are part of the peyote meetings, they're not sort of drinking, so they've forsworn alcohol. Lots of people kind of break their sort of habits of alcoholism through joining the peyote church, and this is kind of establishing a really good kind of noble, upright, ethical core for a new society.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Mike Jay. He's written extensively on scientific and medical history, and we're talking about his latest book. It's a really great history. Mescaline, A Global History of the First Psychedelic. Mike, I was surprised to read that, like, in the late 1800s, you could actually get mail-ordered peyote buttons.
Yeah. That was just about the time that people started getting interested in collecting cacti, and pharmacists like Park Davis in Detroit had kind of were sort of tinkering around with it, wondering if there was some kind of medicine here because it seemed to keep you awake. You know, maybe there was it could be a stimulant or a heart tonic, and from early on there were people selling it by mail order, and that continued all the way through into the 60s. You know, those same companies who were selling it mail order in the 1890s were the people who, you know, William Burroughs and Allen Ginsberg and people were, buying their peyote buttons from in the sort of beat era and through into the early 60s.
And they made a tincture of it, like what they call the tincture of inhalonium?
That's right. They were very interested. At that time, you know, pharmacy had a lot of narcotics and a lot of sedatives. You know, there was opium and morphine and all these kind of chloral hydrates and all these, downers and kind of sleepy things. But the only stimulants that was, that really worked, that was selling well, was cocaine, which was, you know, and this was the time that people were starting to understand that cocaine was pretty bad for you. And, it was very easy to develop a habit. So, people like Park Davis at this point was starting to look around for something that might be, you know, a useful stimulant, but, not so dangerous and damaging. And, you could get this tincture of anhalonium. You know, you could order it from your pharmacists anytime, like from the 1890s through to the 1930s.
Now, psychology becomes fascinated by the effects of mescaline, mainly because they start to view it as a psychomimetic. They think that it represents maybe what's going on in the physical brain, or it's affecting the brain the same way that schizophrenia and other disorders affect the brain.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there's from early on when people start experimenting with mescaline, and mescaline becomes available as a sort of pure drug, you know, 100 years ago, actually, in 1919, so you don't have to mess around with cactus tinctures anymore. From that point on, people are very interested, and they kind of go, well, this kind of makes people sort of confused and makes them hallucinate, and they have kind of strange sort of false memories, and their speech becomes disjointed. Doesn't this remind us of something? So you start to get the idea that, you know, this is something that, you know, is similar in some way to psychosis or schizophrenia. But what's interesting about it for the scientists is that, yeah, all that is happening, but also you're perfectly well aware that you've taken a drug. You know, you can... you can answer questions, you can sort of give it in controlled situations in a laboratory, so it becomes you know, more than a therapeutic tool at that point to begin with. It's just like a tool for investigating these strange forms of consciousness, the things, parts of the mind that you can't normally access.
It's amazing. It's like a who's who of or early psychology and psychiatry. So you have people like Havelock Ellis and William James sort of like taking mescaline and then writing about it. William James, there's a word he used. He described his experience as a real Katzenjammer.
Yeah.
that to me, you know, the only thing I think of is the old comic strip of the Katzenjammer kids.
Right, right. Yes, I hadn't made that connection, but yeah, you're absolutely right. So I guess this is like, we'd say, kind of a screaming hangover or something now.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, this is the thing, because of peyote's sort of physical effects. You know, some people... just seem to kind of, you know, like Havelock Ellis, for example, you know, there's a bit of nausea or whatever, but he's so fascinated by the aesthetics, by the visuals of what he's seeing, he just describes them for pages and pages. But other people, like William James, get taken the other way. They just can't get past the horrible physical sensations, and James just has a nightmare. He has kind of 24 hours of, you know, intense gastric upset and no visions at all.
There are so many interesting people that end up writing about their experiences with mescaline that are in your book. Over the course of the 20th century, the spiritual dimensions of peyote, as you write, can sort of re-enchant the Western culture. That's a phrase you use. But some of the people are just wild. Aleister Crowley.
Yeah.
It's like people who don't know who he is, talk to me about who Aleister Crowley is.
He came out of the sort of decadent 1890s in London.
Yeah,
he was a poet, but he was also a magician. He's kind of probably the most influential figure in sort of 20th century Western ritual magic. He was part of this legendary order, the Golden Dawn, before he started his own order. And he had all kinds of elaborate rituals and ceremonies, which he puts himself through, sometimes on his own, sometimes sort of leading disciples, using music and dance and chants and drugs of all kinds. He was kind of fascinated with drugs that put you into a different mental space where you could, you know, contact spirits or engage with kind of different entities, or just reorientate your connection to the world in some way. So he tried pretty much everything he could lay his hands on. He had a good friend who he worked with, who was an analytical chemist, and they spent a lot of time cooking up drugs. And Crowley was probably the first person in the West to use mescaline, or anhalonium, as he called it, for spiritual purposes. And there were kind of big public ceremonies, you know, invocation of Saturn and so on, where he where he kind of passed it around.
There are people like Mabel Dodge. That's, again, you could write an entire book about that person.
Her story is just fascinating.
And it all ends up in Taos, New Mexico, where to this day, it's sort of renowned as this sort of really earthy, crunchy spiritual center. And it starts there with Mabel Dodge, who starts out in New York City in 1914. And then later she becomes anti-peyote. Anti-mescaline.
Yeah, she does. I mean, she she leaves this great description of, she and her bohemian set are just having an evening in Greenwich Village in 1914, and this kind of slightly randomly, this anthropologist appears with some peyote buttons, and they kind of sit down and do a ceremony, and it all spins really out of control. She then ends up going to New Mexico and settling in Taos, and she becomes Mabel Dodge Lewin. Her final husband, Tony Lewin, is from the Indian from the Taos Pueblo, and he's a peyotist. But she, by this time, is convinced that it's a terrible thing that kind of destroys your mind, and she becomes a real kind of rabid anti-peyote campaigner and keeps trying to, get it banned and get people in the Taos Pueblo arrested for using it. The other thing that she does is the other person that she brings down from New York to New Mexico is a kind of crusading progressive young lawyer called John Collier. And he arrives in Taos as well, and lives in her famous ranch with her and D.H. Lawrence. And he takes up the cause of the Indians. And under Roosevelt and the Indian New Deal in the 1930s, he becomes Indian commissioner, and he is an absolutely passionate advocate of allowing Indians to, not interfering with their spiritual practices. So not only does Mabel Dodge Lewin become an anti-peyote campaigner, but she actually brings down to Taos the person who kind of, enshrines the right to take peyote in Indian culture.
Jean-Paul Sartre, that sounded like a bad trip in the vernacular of the day.
It sounds like a bad trip. Sartre doesn't write much about it,
but he wrote Nausea. I'll tell you, I've read Nausea. Yeah. Nausea sounds like the results of that.
It really does. Nausea, there's this quality of his writing at that time. He's just a friend of his who's a psychiatrist says to him, in 1935, do you mind if I inject you with some mescaline and we'll see how that goes, and I want to know what you make of it. We don't hear much from him directly, but then kind of out comes Nausea, and it's just a theme in that novel that don't look at reality too closely. Every time you kind of get a bit of a close-up on what the world is really like, it's always kind of icky and slimy and disgusting.
He saw lobsters a lot. He saw lobsters out of the sort of his peripheral vision were just all over the place.
Yes, he's got... Simone de Beauvoir kind of tells us that he believed he was being followed around by crabs and lobsters. And Sartre did say later that after his mescaline trip, he felt he was being followed around by these crabs, and they were following him into lectures, and he was talking to them before the lecture saying, okay, you guys just keep quiet while I do my teaching. And then curiously, he did a interview late in his life, sort of many decades later in the 1970s, and he's asked about this. And he says, oh, mescaline, that was great. Yeah, I remember that.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, after the fact.
So, who knows, exactly. Either it precipitated a nervous breakdown, or maybe it was a couple of beautiful afternoons. Who knows?
Now, we're almost out of time, and we've barely scratched the surface of this book. But I want to mention a talk about mescaline today. You mentioned at the end of the book, really the sort of an inheritor is ecstasy.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think, that's always the question of what's happened to mescaline today. As we said, it's this kind of legendary substance that everybody's heard of, but nobody's taken. And I think part of the reason for that is the chemist Alexander Shulgin, who took mescaline in 1960 and had an amazing transformative time and started looking around for other similar molecules and discovered dozens of them, including MDMA that we now call ecstasy. And I think that's kind of the answer to where mescaline went, really, is that, that suddenly we turned out these synthetic versions that instead of being 12 hours are kind of 3 or 4 hours, that instead of being this really heavy physical nauseous body load are actually kind of quite tingly and pleasant. And MDMA, ecstasy, and all those, I kind of would describe them as they're the sort of stepchildren of mescaline. They're kind of mescaline tamed for a new chemical generation.
Yeah, mescaline light.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, again, we just have a minute left, but you've actually been in one of the traditional ethnic peyote ceremonies. You end the book with a wonderful description, and it's a very serious ceremony. We should mention that right off.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, it was hard to know how to write about it because I didn't want to do that kind of here I am in a teepee with a bunch of Comanches. That just felt kind of cheesy, you know, because I didn't want to sort of put myself at the forefront of it. It was an extraordinary, extraordinary experience to be there. I connected with a group of Comanche people in Oklahoma who have very, very deep roots into the lineage and the history of this, and they invited me to attend a ceremony, and it was extraordinary. That was really, for me, a moment when all the pieces of the story came together.
Now, are they doing this legally or illegally?
They're doing it legally. The Native American Church have... constituted in 1918, as a church, so they're protected under the First Amendment. They've suffered, they've been through legal battles of all kinds, attempted federal bans, and there was nearly all came apart in the 1990s, but it's now protected under federal law. And there are more people doing it than ever. The Native American Church is bigger than it's ever been. So just at this time when mescal in itself has kind of completely disappeared from Western drug culture, then, the peyote ceremony is now kind of, is now sort of huge and thriving.
We're completely out of time. Again, there's so much more in this book. It's a rich history and a fascinating and complex history. My guest tonight is Mike Jay. He's written extensively on scientific and medical history. We've been talking about his latest book, Mescaline, A Global History of the First Psychedelic. Mike, it's been a real pleasure.
It's been a real pleasure talking to you, Mark.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.